You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network. I'm Dan Gould. How many Alzheimer's caregivers are there in Virginia? How much does the caregiving role cost the female caregiver? What percentage of the median household income for people over 65 in Charlottesville does a year in a nursing home represent? These and many more questions are answered by Dr. Richard Lindsay in this interesting podcast on geriatric care. Richard W. Lindsay, M.D., Emeritus Professor of Internal Medicine and Family Practice, and former head of the Section of Geriatric Medicine, University of Virginia Health Center, grew up in upstate New York, where his father was a family physician. He attended Cornell University and New York Medical College, from which he received his M.D. degree and where he was a member of the Alpha Omega Alpha. Following an internship at Buffalo General Hospital in Buffalo, New York, Dr. Lindsay practiced briefly with his father in Old Forge, New York, and then completed a residency in internal medicine at the University of Virginia Hospital. Following active duty as a major in the U.S. Army Medical Corps, in 1969 he joined the facility of the Department of Internal Medicine at UVA. Dr. Lindsay spoke at the Wednesday, February 12, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Bob McGrath. Our podcast is entitled Caregiving, The Unexpected Career. Here's Bob McGrath.
I'm Bob McGrath. I'm President of Senior Statesmen of Virginia, and it's my pleasure to welcome all members here today, but also anybody else who just happened to come to hear Dr. Lindsay. I want to say that we're always happy to have new members. Our membership dues are all of $20 a year, and you get a lot of payback for that $20. You get a newsletter, and you get to come to the annual business meeting. But anybody here, please, we're always looking. SSV is about having outstanding speakers and programs on interesting subjects, and we do our best to think about what those programs should be. But any of you, if you have any of your own good ideas, please pass them on to us. Now, I want to just take a second and have the members of the Senior Statesman Board who are here, they all are tagged with these blue things, and stand up, everybody. Jeff Gould is in the back. John McCauley, Vice President, is over there. Charlie Smith. Jim Peterson back there, who's our treasurer, membership chairman, and on top of that, AV czar. So he does everything for us. And please, who am I missing? Oh, and Nancy Hunt back there with her blue tag. So after the meeting, if you have anything to say, any ideas, suggestions, please tell one of us, and we'd like to hear about it. I also want to ask, our membership has been growing beautifully lately. We now have, as of December 31st, we had 161 members, and we're having, we think, quite good attendance at these meetings, which of course reflects the fact that we're having interesting programs with great speakers. But it also depends on publicizing what we're doing. And we do our best to contact the local media and so forth and so on. But if any of you have backgrounds in publicity, dealing with media, whatever, we'd more than love to have you join in our efforts and help us. So also tell us about that if at the end of the meeting if you have any expertise in such. Now I want to introduce our speaker, Dr. Richard Lindsay. I know many of you already know him. Dr. Lindsay is a very distinguished and widely recognized specialist in geriatric medicine and in all sorts of issues associated with aging. Dr. Lindsay attended Cornell, and then he did his medical education and training at New York Medical College, Buffalo General Hospital, and the University of Virginia. After a stint as a major in the Medical Corps of the U.S. Army, he joined the University of Virginia faculty in internal medicine, but as nearly as I can tell, almost immediately he began, along with a few others in the country, to invent the field of geriatric medicine. He was awarded one of the original 7 geriatric medicine academic awards from the National Institute of Aging. Now, for those of you that don't know, that's one of the institutes of the National Institutes of Health. And he used that grant as a basis to develop Virginia's geriatric curriculum. And he was head of the University of Virginia's division and section of geriatrics for many, many years. At the national level, he's been president and chair of the board of directors of the American Geriatric Society. At our Commonwealth level, he's been a member of governor's advisory committees on aging under 5 different governors. He's now serving on the Commonwealth Council on Aging. And here at our local level, he serves on the board of directors of the Jefferson Area Board on Aging, JABA. Dr. Lindsay has received so many important awards for his work on aging that I'm going to punt. And I'm just going to encourage you, if you haven't done it already, to look at our newsletter and just look at the set of wonderful awards that he deserved and was awarded. One of his awards from the Virginia Association of Nonprofit Homes for the Aging, I think, nicely captures the scope of what Dr. Lindsay has accomplished. He received their Distinguished Service Award for outstanding contributions to the people of Virginia throughout his career through educational programs, advocacy, and for research. Now, he's going to talk to us today. The title is Caregiving, the Unexpected Career. Dr. Lindsay.
Well, thank you, Bob, for that most generous introduction, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being brave enough to come out in the face of the storm. I'm kind of the warm-up back. You know, the real thing that's coming is the big storm this afternoon, so I'm in the warm-up for that. So. And I was thinking about that. I always like to begin with a little humor, and I heard a story the other day about somebody who had difficulty with temperature. It had to do with two ladies were up in heaven, and they were comparing how they got there. And one lady said to the other, "How did you get here?" And she said, "Well, I froze to death." She said, "Oh," the first one said, "that must have been terrible." She said, "No, it was very quiet, peaceful, and just got colder, and here I am." She said, "What about you?" She said, "Well," she said, "that's a different story." She said, "I was concerned my husband was fooling around, and I decided I'd leave work early and go home and catch him. So I went home in the middle of the afternoon, opened the door, and here he was sitting in front of the TV having a beer, and everything looked all right, but I was certain that something was going on. So I ran up the stairs and searched in every bedroom, then ran up in the attic and searched the attic, ran down to the cellar and was searching the cellar and running back up the stairs, and all of a sudden I had a heart attack and I died. And the other lady said, "Well, you know, it's too bad you didn't look in the freezer. We'd both be alive today." So there you go. So with that in mind, we'll go ahead and get started. Well, I gave you some questions just to make you realize that the average American doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about some of the impact that aging has in its community and some of the surrounding things. And so we're going to talk about some of these issues, about the Affordable Care Act, some of the median household income, and above all, we're going to talk about caregiving, which is a very, very important thing. This is a picture, obviously, of a very familiar scene to all of you. It looks at the sunset over Charlottesville. And depending upon, I had seen the movie the night before I took this picture called No Country for Old Men. And remember, it was a tough movie. And so the question I asked myself was something different. I said, is Albemarle, Charlottesville, and Virginia a country for old men and old women? And that's what we're going to be talking about in another thing. And my premise is it can be, but only with continued support for people like senior statesmen. So we'll talk about that, and we're going to go on with that. I talk fast, and I've tried to slow down, but it's never worked, so I just want you to know that's my own plane. I travel at a pretty good speed, and I talk the same way, so that's it. I do have a collection of bumper stickers, and I wanted to show you the one I have in my own car. My own car has one that says, "I believe in having sex on the first date. At my age, there may be a second one." So that's another critical issue. And then the newest one I've got is this one. It says, "We have pension sex, a little each month, but not enough to live on." I think that's the other great. Finally, old age is all in your head, and we have a lot of things like false teeth and so forth. So it gets serious. This is one that gets into caregiving, and it's my favorite cartoon strip. And you can see what Opal and the lady are talking about. It says, some women get used to being mom after their children leave. Not uncommon for them to transfer mothering onto their husbands. "Are you one of those, Opal?" she asks. "Do you feel like mothering your husband?" Opal says, "Yes, sometimes." "Really?" she says. "Sometimes you want a mother, Earl?" "Mother. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said smother." So that's it. We're not talking about that. We're getting serious. We're talking about the caregiving career, and it's an unexpected career. And it's a career that can be the most satisfying thing anybody can do. Without question, the rewards of caring for a loved one are just inestimable. At the same time, it could be a very, very difficult and very taxing career, and so we're going to talk about that. My own career in caregiving began with my parents. This is my mom and dad. My dad was a country doctor. My mom had very severe Alzheimer's disease. Spent the latter part of her life here in Charlottesville and were involved with my family and my home. And I owe them a great deal, first of all. I always show their picture to thank them, but also to realize that that's how I got exposed to caregiving. At the time, I was a professional, one of the leaders in the field of aging, but I didn't do a good job with my mother. And the point is that all of us, when we're involved with loved ones, make it a very different equation. So we're going to talk about that. And you can see how rewarding it is to this lady. But you can also see up here a lady who's physically abusing the person she's giving care to. So the impact of caregiving is a very, very difficult situation for many people, and we're going to talk about that over and over. So if you're looking for a job that consists of hard work, bad hours, and no pay, then raise your hand and become a caregiver, because that's what it is. It's a really, really taxing job. Now, just a few words about aging itself. Aging itself, Lindsay's definition of aging has nothing to do with your chronological age. I don't care whether you're 95 or 45. What I care about is whether you can wipe yourself, feed yourself, and dress yourself. If you can, by Lindsay's definition, you're not old. And conversely, at 45, if you can't, you are. So get away from the chronological definition, get into the functional one. What we're looking down the barrel of is something that really is frightening. And it's closer than most people think. Every day since January 2008 and for the next 20 years, 10,000 boomers become eligible for Medicare and Social Security. And that's why the systems are under such financial trouble. Very, very difficult. And we're predicting that by 2030, what we're talking on 2050, 82 million Americans over the age of 65. 82 million. And I think, as I said, the problem is that's an old statement. It ain't in the Chesapeake anymore. It's around us. It's here. It's in Charlottesville. And I think we've got to pay a lot more attention to it. Now, is it just a local phenomenon? No, it's not. This shows you 1991. You can see countries with greater than 20% over 60, mainly Scandinavian, Central Europe. But look by 2020. The whole of North America, all of Europe, part of Asia begins to turn old. So it's a very, very worldwide phenomenon. And this is very recent data. This came in the last 10 days. And what they looked at was what countries think about that. Are they worried about it? And you can see in Japan, 87% cause a major problem, their population aging. Where's the U.S.? 26% of people in this country think it's a major problem. And that's been the problem. Nobody pays any attention to it. And as a result, we're in trouble. We're behind. So it's a very difficult situation. Inside the wave, dramatic differences. 2000, large, non-Hispanic, white population, relatively small minority population. But look at 2020, 50. Huge decrease in the non-Hispanic, white population and a dramatic increase in the minority population, Hispanics, African Americans, so forth, until by 2042, this is a country that will have a minority majority. The minority population will be the majority. Has huge impact upon things like voting, those kinds of issues. And I tell the medical students, if you don't speak Spanish, you're going to be left behind. And I think it's a really interesting problem, so we'll roll along. Virginia, same thing. Current population, about 7.7 million, 12% over 65. By 2030, up to 19%, one in five Virginians will be over 65. And in Virginia, dramatic increase in the mixing, the minority population. So very, very interesting phenomenon. Causes problems, because you can't speak the same language many of the immigrant population you deal with. That's a big problem for hospitals. And you can see in Northern Virginia already the minority population below 40 exceeds the white non-Hispanic population. So it's very, very close in many parts of the country. And as I say, we're going to be looking down this year. About 2009, it gets to be 50-50, and pretty soon it goes the other way, so it's tough. What about Albemarle County? Well, you can see the actual population in people over 65 in early days, 9,900. But you can see our population is 14,000, and it's going to go, by 2030, up to 18,000. So again, a big, big, big increase, and you can see that all these counties are showing significant percent increase, depending upon the original size where they start. So it's going to be a universal phenomenon for people in this area. How long do you want to live? Well, that's another interesting part of the whole equation. Clearly, what we've done is dramatic. 1900, the average life expectancy for a woman was 47. You had your family, had your kids, and you were gone. Now it's a little over 81 for women in this country. So we've done a tremendous job increasing life expectancy. Men are coming up very close now. We are catching up. We're not doing well internationally. Places like Japan and so forth have much, much greater life expectancy than we do. We rank about 42nd in the world in terms of life expectancy. But if you look closely inside the equation, that's where it gets messy. Average life expectancy for a woman, a white woman in this country, is now 81. The average life expectancy for a black male is 70. 11 years difference. We're going to talk about the reasons for that, some of the economic factors, some of the other factors that are there. And these are the big killers. Heart disease is number one, cancer, stroke, lung disease, accidents, and finally Alzheimer's is now in sixth place. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So while we've gotten people living longer, we've also got a peer problem. At the upper end, the last few years, you've had years with disability, unable to function at your optimal level. So on the one hand, longer lifespan, but the price we've paid is a greater population with a disability. And so there's something called active life expectancy. What is that? Well, this shows you ages across the bottom, and it gives you the number of years you got left to be at 65 and at 85. At 65, they give you 16 and a half years. That's a pretty good number. I'd take that bet anytime. And even at 85, it gives you 7.3 years to live. But look at the bottom line. Much more pessimistic numbers. 10 at 65, only 2. What's the difference? This is the number of years you and I got to live that we'd be independent. We will not need help, won't need assistance. So the point I made earlier is that that period of time with disability impacts upon whether you and I need services. So that's one of the things we're going to be talking about. So I'm a tennis player. I like to play tennis. I'm out playing tennis. I get pain in my knee. So I go to the doc and he says, take some Motrin. So I take the Motrin. And it gets better for a while, but then it gets worse. Now I go back to him and he said, and I get to the point where I can't play. I've become disabled. So he says, Dick, you've got a choice. You can get a new knee or you can quit playing tennis. Neither of which I want to do. So what I'm trying to do and what we've got to do, you and I as individuals, we've got to, the point at which I first got the pain is called morbidity. And over here is the time I check out when I die. What we're trying to do is move the point at which I get first symptoms over. I want to be out there playing my arch enemy, whack the ball, clutch my chest and die. That's how I want to go. Now, other people got other ways they want to go, but that's the way Lindsay wants to go. So I only share that with you. Point being that that's what we're trying to move, is this point of give you more, if you will, health span. Not lifespan, but health span, where you and I are healthy longer. And the boomers themselves have been a big, big clot in the system. They came right after the vets came home from World War II. It began in 1946. And you can see they started to jam the nurseries, then the schools, then the colleges, then the labor market. And now they're jamming the entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security. They're coming online with huge, huge numbers. And so it's a lot like that snake with nothing there. Then all of a sudden this huge bolus, the pig's inside the python. There are two ways you can get old. One, you can be born with a disability. And you could obviously age with it. And we're doing a much better job keeping people with disability alive a lot longer. Or, like most of us, you can age into disability, acquiring a chronic disease like arthritis or like hypertension or like heart disease. And unfortunately, the service requirements are exactly the same. So there's a lot of overlap between these two populations. Now, here's an interesting problem, though. This is a family where the only living relatives of this child who had a birth injury are the mom and dad, both in their early 80s. And if they die, who's going to take care of that child? Society hasn't solved that problem. So it's another example of the kinds of questions that are out there. And then, as you know, as we saw the population after the war, they moved into the suburbs, they had their kids, now the kids are gone, and they're out there. So the question is, how do we get services to the suburbs, where a lot of people are living, increasing this population? Not only that, the households are different. Used to be, the characteristic household had a lot of kids, people were married, and that's it. Now you see all kinds of mixtures, single-person households, non-family, other family, married without children, married without no children. So a lot of new things, a lot of new parts of the equation. And you don't see this traditional picture as much as you see this kind of picture. And here's another example of what I'm talking about. An Asian-American lady, early 80s, and one additional thing. This is a lady with Alzheimer's who lives alone. Now, first of all, who knows she's got Alzheimer's? And number two, what do you do about it? When she lives alone is out in the suburbs. Very vexing questions. And Rosalind Carter, who heads the Carter Institute, said, I think, that something that I want to call to your attention. In this room, everybody in this room is going to be one of the four categories I'm going to show you. First category is going to be something that says those who have been caregivers, and some of you have been. Next one, those who are currently giving care. Some of you are doing that. Another one, those who expect to be caregivers, and then the one that's eligible for me, those who will need a caregiver. But everybody in this room is one of those categories. Everybody. And that's the reason that caregiving is such an important part of what we're going to talk about. And you can see somewhere between 34 and 41 million Americans give unpaid care. And if the system had to pay for that, if the govs had to pay for that, this country would really be in red ink, much more so than it is already. Typical caregiver, a woman of 46, works 20 hours per week giving care and has a regular job as well. Unpaid caregivers give 90% of the care provided at home. Not doctors, not nurses, not CNAs, not anybody but family members does that kind of caregiving. And if you total it up, if you gave them $8.10 an hour and factored the number of hours with the number of people involved, the total amount that's worth exceeds everything the country's doing, exceeds the Medicaid bill. It's a huge, huge amount of volunteer labor. So it's a big, big, big thing. Who is the caregiver? Well, we've already talked about that. Usually caring for a close relative, like your mom, and they've got an annual income of roughly $35,000, as you'll see a little bit later. And it penetrates a lot of households in the U.S. A lot of households are involved in caregiving. Some of them are only taking care of kids with disabilities. Not a big chunk, only adults. And then there's a group that has a really tough job. They're doing care for both age groups, old and young. Really tough. So it's a tough business. You can see who they care for: mothers, grandmothers, fathers, mother-in-law, spouses, siblings, daughter-in-law, sons, and non-relatives. So they're involved in giving care to everybody. And then this is probably the most striking figure I want you to remember. For the first time in all of recorded history, and that's a long time, first time in all of recorded history, by 2020, there were more people over the age of 65 in the world than will be kids under the age of 5. So you've got a population paradox, which is really, really interesting. And this is important to realize, because back in 1900, people had to have big families, because a lot of them didn't survive. But more importantly, when they got to be advanced ages themselves, they had somebody to fall back on. But if you move it up to 2030, what you see is a very different equation. Fewer children, and then all of them, you've added to the equation the caregiving responsibility of parents and grandparents. So the worker today has a lot more responsibilities than we ever had. And this shows what's happened. This is the current boomer population. They're between 45 and 65, let's say, and they're moving up the age group. And currently, they're the ones who provide care to their older people. So the caregiving ratio is now about 10 people, giving, or 7 people, giving care for everyone that needs the care. But as you age the boomers who are given this bulk of the care, the question is, what's following them? Well, what's following them is a low birth rate. So there aren't many kids. And as a result, the number of caregivers available for their care is dropping off until by about 2050, it gets down to 1 in 3. So that's the reason the country's in trouble from a caregiving standpoint. The importance of that is here. 50% of old people like me who have a long-term care need but have no family available to care for them are in nursing homes. Half of them. On the other hand, if you've got a family, only 7%. So the importance of having a family and being able to have that family give you care is inestimable in terms of costs, things of that nature. And you can't read this very well, but this is the other big new change in the caregiving situation. What it says is 1 child in 10 in the U.S. lives with a grandparent. And 41% of the time, the grandparents raising those kids. 41% of the time. So there's another additional addition to this whole equation. That's the role of the grandparents. We're not going to talk about that today. Now, the boomers have one thing in their mind, uppermost, where they want to be taken care of. And they do not want to go to the hospital. They don't want assisted living. They don't want nursing homes. They want to stay at home. So that's going to be something we'll have to deal with as we go along. And then, as you know, what happens to women? Women live longer, but pretty soon they're facing the equation of being alone. Almost 70% of women age 75 are widowed, divorced, or never married, compared to about 30% of men. So the biggest key to having a caregiver in place is to be married. And that's a tough equation. We'll again come back to that. And this shows you what I've been talking about for the last 5 minutes. There's change between 2000 and 2050 in terms of demand for caregivers. And this is the paid workforce. This is the informal one, the family members. It's going to escalate to a point that's just unbelievable. And one of the interesting things that's happened along the way is that as we've had this demand for a workforce, one of the parts that's changed is we're now seeing workers over age 55 become involved in caregiving, both particularly in the paid workforce. Here's a good example. This is a guy, 72, who's shaving his colleague, who's about 81. Paid worker. And we're seeing more and more of that today in the business. Virginia's got a pretty good-sized direct workforce in 212. You've got a bunch of nursing assistants, personal care. These are the paid employees. That's that bottom green line, that little tiny line compared to the informal caregivers. Are they well trained? Yeah, Virginia does a good job. They exceed the federal limits in most all these things for nurses' aides, home health aides. So I think we've got a good start. But as you'll see in a minute, that's something I want to talk about. This, of course, is Obamacare. This is a diagram of it. You can see it's a simple plan. And you can see the president up here and your Secretary Sebelius down here. And my question about it is not that we didn't need to change. We did need to change. The question I got is going to be what it's going to cost us. And I have real concern about the cost of Obamacare for a lot of reasons I won't talk about today. The real guts and bottom of that is they want to change health care, and they want to have a system where it changes the delivery system to one where you and I have a source of primary care. Everybody has a medical home where you go and they know you. They know about your history. They know how to take care of you. That's what they're aiming for. And the big thrust is to deinstitutionalize the population, to get them out of hospital, to get them out of nursing homes, to get them home. And to do that, we're going to have to change the overall thing. So health care reform is what they're aiming for, and they want to close. They don't want to close. They want to decrease places like this that are being built, and they want to get away from this kind of intensive care. What they want to do is give you and I care at home. A lot of different means. We'll cover some of that. And to do that, we have to shift to a model that deals with chronic care, because that's what older people have: arthritis, diabetes, hypertension.
Hospitals are dangerous places for older people. 15% of patients greater than 70 years decline during hospitalization in terms of their ADLs, dressing, clothing. So they get older by Lindsay's definition. Another 20% leave the hospital without recovering pre-hospital ability. So they're not good places for older people, and that's why I like the current model. So we're looking on the transition. How do you take somebody who's been hospitalized and get them safely to a home or assisted living, wherever they're going to go? And the communication level in the past has been terrible. So we've landed over here with very little information. Nobody knows what's going on. It takes you 30 days to get the record from the hospital. So it's not been a good situation. So what they're trying to do is put in place a system now which deals with the transition between the hospital and home. While you're in the hospital, the team evaluates you, goes over what you're going to do at home. And then when you go home, the team follows you and gives you the kind of care and follow-up you need. The other thing they're adding is they're adding a lot of information that the patient needs to be able to manage their own condition. Self-education. And finally, if you've got a lot of things going on at once, they put together teams that say, this is somebody who's at risk to be rehospitalized. We're going to stop that. And the team works with you in the hospital, works with you at home, and tries to prevent your hospitalization. So in the future, get used to the idea that you're going to see a lot of people other than the doc. It's a team. You may see the physical therapist, the occupational therapist, the nurse practitioner. And the one thing they've forgotten about is the key player, and that's the family caregiver. It's critical that the family caregiver play an important role in this team. Not be dictated to, but in fact be part of the decision-making process. Decides what's going to happen to you or I. And that's something we're really going to have to lean on in the future to get it done. We'll see what happens. So eventually what we're going to try and do, theoretically, is take all these puzzle pieces and put them together for the benefit of the patient. You've got to link the hospital, the insurance companies, the family caregiver, primary care doctors, the community, home health agency, all of them shore up that family caregiver. What about long-term care itself? Well, that's an interesting thing. This is my friend Bill Thomas. Bill Thomas grew up in Utica, New York, and is a close friend. But Bill wants to stop buildings like this. This is a nursing home in Massachusetts. He wants to build houses where you have 6 residents, staff in the house, and he wants to green the industry. Nursing home is obviously going to decrease in terms of importance if we do a good job at home. And the Obamacare originally had something called CLASS, Community Living Assistance Support Services. It was part of the act. But when they got around to figuring out the cost, it was a voluntary thing. You gave them voluntary contributions from your payroll as you got older, and then when you got to a certain age, you were eligible for it. But when they looked at the bottom line, it didn't compute. You lost money. The government lost a whole lot of money. So, in fact, CLASS is dismissed, and there is no long-term care piece in Obamacare. None. So for those of us who need long-term care, the question is, what do you have? Got Medicare. That's not long-term care. Medicaid, yes, but that means you've got to spend down to be eligible for Medicaid. So the only thing left is private insurance. And private insurance is disappearing. Companies are getting out of the business. It's high-risk business for them. And the cost has gone up. It's expensive to buy long-term care insurance in this country. So that's one of the real questions for the U.S. What are we going to do in the future about long-term care? This looks at the local situation. It shows you the median household income for people over 65 in Charlottesville is $40,000. Average cost in 2013 in nursing home in Charlottesville was $77,000. That's 191% of the median income. 191% of what somebody has to spend a year in a nursing home. If you look at home care costs $31,000, and that's 77% of the median income. So right away, you get some idea of the tremendous financial pressure people are under. This looks at assisted living. It shows you the average cost of a month's assisted living in every state in the United States. And you can see Virginia's about $3,700, $3,800. But remember, assisted living works in the following way. If you've got running water and air, that's one price. But if you start adding services, the price goes up. And it goes up fairly dramatically. And the point I make to you is, this is for people who got money. Assisted living is not available to people for the most part who don't have income. That's why the Jefferson Area Board for Aging does a remarkable job with things like Mountainside, where you put in place something where people who don't have a lot of income can operate and live. It's a critical need, affordable housing for seniors, if you will. And there's a service where you can put in your age. This I did last year. I'm now 80, but at 79, I put in my situation, and they have a thing which equates what you'll need. They predicted that I would need 3 years along of nursing home care, and the cost I should have available around $255,000. For assisted living, $182,000. And for home care, $91,000. Now, I don't know whether right or wrong. The point I make to you is that those are scary figures for somebody who's looking down the barrel of what we're looking at my age. That's a very interesting and, I think, important phenomenon. So I wanted to get around to something else, and that's the gender differences in caregiving.
Caregiving is a woman's issue. It's an amazing thing. Of the professional caregivers in the U.S., 90% are women. Of the informal caregivers, around 75%, three quarters. And the strange thing in this country is that we do not look at caregiving as valuable. You can be a carpenter, and that's got more value than taking care of my mother or my aunt. And that's the bottom line that's wrong with that equation. So if you figured out $8.10 an hour just for what women do, they're contributing roughly $148 billion to the economy if we had to pay for it. $108 billion annually. And the vast majority of women caregivers report significant conflict between the many things they do. For example, they got a job. They got a mother to take care of. They got kids to worry about, and they got a husband in the equation. So it's a tremendously conflicting position we put them in. And their role is essential. Men do caregiving, but they do it a different way. If you ask men what they're doing, they're going on the computer to find out where they can put grandma. That's easy for them to do. Women give hands-on care, very different kind of care. And you can see that this is going to be important from a woman's viewpoint from another reason. Women who were 65 in 2000 can expect to live another 19 years to age 84. And in 2000, 40% of women age 65 were living alone. Remember what I said? The key to having somebody there is having somebody there. 51% of women age 80 were living alone. So the older the population of women, the greater the need for caregiving is going to come. 10 reasons that they give care to people. They got old age, cancer, Alzheimer's, all those things are true. But this is what it does to people who are working. And this is a very important and overlooked part of the women's caregiving equation. First of all, 33% have to decrease their work hours. 20% messed up promotion training. 22% had to take a leave of absence. 20% had to switch to full-time to part-time. 16% were forced to quit their jobs. 13% retired early. And then, this is the one that happens on a daily basis. They go in late, they leave early, and they take time off. What we call presenteeism, not absenteeism, presenteeism. They're on the job, but their mind is at home. And their work effort and their product is often secondary to that issue. A very, very important part of the equation. Now, if you look at what it cost them, that's an even more important figure. Because very honestly, women start off with often lower wages. They start off with less Social Security. And they've already done child care. They've already given some time up for child care on the front end. Now they're asked to do it on the other end. And you can see the impact in terms of pensions and Social Security is huge. So, and not only that, when you get around to it, they often end up paying for what happens. Prescriptions, ramp for a wheelchair comes out of the caregiver's pocket. Very, very difficult situation. And what do they do? Well, they do all kinds of stuff. They get them dressed, they take them to the toilet, they do all kinds. But now, when hospitals are kicking people out earlier, they're much sicker. So what they end up doing is what nurses used to do. They end up changing terrible wounds, change the dressing, end up doing home dialysis. The caregiver does this, not the nurse coming in. And I'm saying to you, we've increased their responsibility. And most importantly, we've asked them to help solve everyday problems, and then we've asked them to solve the riddle of getting through the healthcare system. Where do you go for this? Where do you go for that? So the responsibility and the level of acuity has just been a dramatic change. These are just some of the things they're doing now. They're working hospital beds. They're working scooters. They're operating medical equipment like ventilators, oxygen, tube feedings, home dialysis equipment, and suction equipment, all being done by a person who's never been trained professionally. To do a good job? Yeah, for the most part. Have they been offered the opportunity for training? Some. Do we need more? Whole lot more. If we're going to ask the level of acuity to increase what we've done, these people have got to be trained better. And above all, this is where it comes in. They're being now given the opportunity to give medicines IV. And usually the people who are getting the care are on five or six different medications, all requiring very careful administration. So we've taxed these people with a responsibility that's hard to measure and a very important one. So Lindsay's basic premise is this. These are the basic things that public health is worried about. Diabetes, cancer, sexually transmitted disease like AIDS, influenza. And I want to add one more to the list. I want to add caregiving to the list for the reasons I've told you about. Has a huge impact on the health. I'd like a sign that says I like smoking, except the picture would be for caregivers. Caregiving is a life deferred. You give up vacations. Your job situation we've just described changes drastically. Families are often torn apart by it. And most, and what I want to leave you with, is this personal health thing. You stop getting mammograms, flu shots. Don't go to the doctor. Don't get dental care. Don't exercise. And above all, don't get a chance to relax. The end result is the fact that all these things happen with much less opportunity. And this is a list of what happens to the people who are given care. They get less sleep. They're stressed out. They have pain, aches developing. 30 to 50% of them develop significant depression.
as a result of carrier. The longer it goes, the more they get. Headaches. If you've got cardiovascular disease, it gets worse. So the health impact is huge. And I just leave it that. And caregivers, when they start, think they're ready to take on the world. And they often do. But the point is, as time goes along, they get overwhelmed. They just get wiped out by the amount of responsibility and tough. Why do they do that? Well, very simply, they put the needs of their family over their own first. That's why they do it. They are very, very important to that. And you can see all of them show the effects of what we just talked about. Stress, less time with the family, taking more medications themselves. 78% want more information. If you give more information and you train them, they can be a much different caregiver. And you can see that's a very important part of it. And the doctors are involved. For example, if you see somebody who's giving care and they come to me, a lot of the times I don't know they're a caregiver because they never say a word. And the individual I'm seeing may have some other problem. And I'm busy, so I don't ask about it. And more importantly, the doctors have an opportunity to tell somebody who's a caregiver, this is what you need to do to change your lifestyle, to make you stay healthier longer. And a lot of them don't do that. Don't even ask about it. So I'm trying to train the next generation. This, of course, is my mom. My mom's office was in the house. The phone was always on the table. And she was a great mom and did my dad's books, did all the appointments, and was a remarkable lady with only a high school education. But the point I make to you is that this shows what happens to populations as they age in terms of the amount of Alzheimer's. By the time you get in the 80s, you get up around 35-40% of people have Alzheimer's disease or some form of dementia. On the other hand, we're beginning to see a different population. This is a nurse, 47 years of age, got a kid in high school, kid in grade school, husband. She's got early Alzheimer's disease. Requires a totally different care plan than my mother did. Totally different capabilities, because she got kids to worry about as well. This gives you some idea of the future. Currently, every 68 seconds, somebody's developing Alzheimer's. They're predicting by 2050, it'll be down to every 33 seconds. Halfway around the watch, somebody will pick it up. And you can see, of the 82 million boomers, they're predicting 14 million will have some form of dementia. And you can see it's much more common in women than it is in men. So it's got a big impact. That's the reason why we're beginning to see the emergence of male caregivers. You can see the number of men involved has just skyrocketed since 1997 because they're involved in taking care of an older spouse, something like that. And this is a very common picture you're going to see. Men caregivers are going to be a very big part of the future. Now, what about the effect it has on other parts of our economy? For example, if somebody's given care, and they go through all that thing we just went through, this is what happens on the other end. This is the employer side of the equation. You can see they have to replace people. They have to deal with absenteeism. They have to deal with workday interruptions. They have crises that somebody has to go home. The total annual cost is horrendous in terms of the U.S. economy. So the importance of shoring up the caregiving, I think, is evident to all of you. Now, what do caregivers want from their employers? Well, the one thing they want is this. They want easier access to flex time. Same thing when they have kids. You want to be able to go and not be penalized and come back to a job when it's all over. And this is what's a study we did in Virginia about 4 years ago with Southeastern Institute of Research. You can see that some of the companies are beginning to recognize that. About 43% of the companies currently doing at least one of these things. But you can see the percent is not 100 in any case. Flexible part-time work, reduced hours, formal leave, sabbaticals. Progressive companies are going to have to face up to this because it's going to be an ever-increasing part of their equation. What do caregivers want from Charlottesville? Well, what they want is one place to go for advice. They want to have one source that can go and get the answers to difficult questions. They want to have affordable services. And then the one that makes a big lot of sense to me is this bottom one. They want service providers that operate with a working caregiver's hours in mind. They want to be able to get what they need when they've got time available to be participants in it. And it's going to be a very important part of it. Virginia has a great resource called Senior Navigator. It's, as you know, a computer source. But this lady works in Washington, got parents in Wise, Virginia, and she can go online using Senior Navigator and find out what the resources are in Wise, what the costs are, and more importantly, who the people are she needs to get help. So I urge you to look at Senior Navigator. Well, the end result of all this pressure that's on people who are caregiving is they begin to feel burned out. Usually by the time they admit it, the place has already burned to the ground. So it's a very, very important thing to recognize it. And one of the things that JABA does very, very well is they provide a daycare service over there on Hillside Drive, as you know. And you can take your Alzheimer's patient over there, drop them off, trained staff will watch them for X number of hours. You can get your hair done, you can see your doctor, you can go to the bank, you can do things, and you can, above all, you can breathe for a minute. And that's the one thing that sustains the caregiver's health. And if you do this, like we do, then you can keep the caregiver giving care. If you don't, and they burn out, it's over. The only thing that can happen to the person that's getting that care is to be institutionalized. So it's a very, very important part of the equation, respite care. So caregiver respite's key. And I think the thing that people aren't aware of sometimes is that there's already in place a pretty good web. You've got to do some things for yourself, and we'll talk about that a little more in just a second. But above all, you've got to look for ways to keep your spirits up. We'll talk about that. And out there, huge amount of resources already in place. The Alzheimer's Association, Caregivers Association. You can go online, you can talk to these groups and get a lot of help. So you're not alone. That's important. What do they want? Well, they want exercise and things that save them time. They want relief from caregiving. They want to reduce their level of stress. And they want something to do with copayment. I tell the young doctors in training, if I'm taking care of an Alzheimer's patient, it's important to worry about what the patient's got. But the real key is to support the caregiver. So I say, if you will, take care of the caregiver. If you do that, then they can continue to give care, and the individual can be taken care of at home. The minute you get the caregiver sick, the institution beckons, and the cost to the system goes out of sight. So caregiving is important. Then you get down to what we're all going to talk about. I heard the man's coming to talk Friday about it, so I won't dwell on it. But this shows you the causes of premature death in the United States. What you see here is that health care, all this talk about Obamacare, and so health care is responsible for 10%. What's this big red section? Behavioral patterns. What are we talking about? Well, we're talking about things like sexual behavior with AIDS, alcohol abuse, motor vehicle deaths, guns, drug-induced. Then the two big ones, obesity, smoking. Smoking kills 435,000 people a year in the United States, roughly 9,000 Virginians. And Robert Wood Johnson put together this graph, which makes, I think, something makes eminent sense to me, and that is that you and I tend to think about health as medical care, health care. That's what everybody thinks about. Not even close to being enough. What we've got to look at is the fact that personal behavior is a big part, living and working conditions, as we'll see in a minute, and finally, economic and social opportunities. All of these things play major roles in why somebody stays healthy or why they don't. And as a result, the system gets taxed. This is some work from the University of Wisconsin. They look at counties. They look at the health of counties. And what they look at is something called health factors, and then they look at eventual outcomes, what the mortality is, what the quality of life is. And along the way, the health factors include behaviors like tobacco use, diet, exercise, alcohol. Then this shows you clinical care, only 20% access to care, quality of care. Then comes social and economic factors, education, employment, income, family and social support, community safety, and then finally physical environment. Well, let's look at that in a little more detail. Well, this shows you what we got here. Albemarle, Buckingham, Charlottesville City, Fluvanna, Greene. And the lower the number, the better the health. And what you see across the board is that in every category, poor or fair health, Albemarle's not in bad shape. But when you get out in the rural areas, you see a very different picture emerge. A lot of reasons. Access, service, environment, economics, all the things we've been talking about. And all I'm saying to you is that clearly, that needs to be addressed in some form. You can't see that anyway. But this shows you a change between 1994 and 2008 in terms of obesity. What you see is, in 1994, this was a skinny country. But by 2008, all this red is fat. At the same time we got fat, we also got sweet. This is a change in diabetes. And look where the diabetes centers in the southeast. In the southeast. And so what we've got now is an epidemic. And some people have chosen to call this epidemic diabesity. Because the combination, they're kissing cousins. They work together. And it's scary. One in 520 young people now becoming diabetic. Very, very. And the cartoon says it all. Remember when we used to have to fatten the kids up first? Don't got to do that anymore. Just watch them. And the point, when we look at the kids, we do scans on them now. What we find is they're already beginning to show thickening in the walls of their heart at age 17, 18, 19. So all I'm saying to you is it's a big problem. And I mentioned to you what the question was. This shows you the portion size in 1950. Between 1950 and now, portion size has increased four times. And the average weight of Americans between 1950 and now has increased 26 pounds. Four times the portion size, 26 pounds increased body weight between 1950 and now. This looks at the other side of the equation, which is the movement side. This shows you three factors, race, age, and how heavy you are. And increasing amounts of walking from the left in the graph to the right. So in every case, regardless of what race you come from, what age you are, or how heavy you are when you start, the more you walk, the more you decrease your risk of cardiovascular disease. Just walking. It's a big thing. And what we're learning is that a lot of the factors that are involved in cardiovascular illness are the same factors that may be involved in dementia. So there's a lot of new studies underway looking at the connection between things like sugar, exercise, and the relationship that with dementia. This is a good example of how the environment affects it. Suppose I send somebody home to exercise in an environment like this. I may never see them again, first of all. They may be slaughtered the next day. You have no idea. So the environment plays a big role for a lot of people. And then, of course, what ails us is city disease. The new workstations are going to be different. They got the treadmill. You can sit from time to time, but the computer's up here. And meanwhile, you exercise. Meetings like we're doing now? No. Everybody sits on a ball or stands. Nobody sits. Very different kind of environment. And I think enlightened employers recognize that. A good employee is a healthy employee. So they're giving them gyms. They're putting gyms in some of the big industries. They're giving them free gym membership. And they're rewarding them with extra days off if, in fact, the individual practices a healthy lifestyle, goes to exercise, that kind of thing. What's the most unhealthful thing you do each day? It's what you're doing right now. It's what you're doing right now. It's sitting. And the point I make to you is that move. No matter what you do, but keep moving. Use every opportunity to move. And this just sums up what we've been talking about. There's a lot of things that you and I do as individuals that are much more important in terms of our health than is the healthcare system itself. And this gets at the other factor. Health varies by income. What you see here is that higher up you go, the poorer the health. And the higher up the bar, the lower the income. So you can see here the people at the poverty level are going to have poor health. This looks at races. It shows you the two minorities here and whites down here. And the minorities are off the dial compared to us with that kind of thing. This looks at education. And it looks at the fact that it doesn't matter what race you are. Upwards, poor health, and decreasing amounts of education. So the higher the bar, the lower the education level. You can see, regardless of the race, poorer the education, the greater likelihood they're going to have poor health. So it's a critical issue. There's a young man I'm very proud of. I trained. He's now the CEO head of the Cleveland Clinic. And he says the Cleveland Clinic's in the wrong business. We're in the sickness business. We got to change. We got to get in the health business. What they do, you can't get a job at Cleveland Clinic if you smoke. And he's led the whole state of Ohio trying to get rid of smoking, taking frying foods out of the cafeterias. And he helps people who want to quit smoking. But what Toby points out is this. 10% of healthcare costs are in this country due to being fat. $147 billion that's worth. Smoking accounts for another $100 billion. $247 billion from just those two parts of the equation. Think of that. And I think the governments are all worried about the fact that the tsunami of aging is going to cause red ink, going to cause the Albemarle County, city, everybody's going to get money. And what they're thinking of is people like this, rooms full of people like that. What we got to recognize is that there's an untapped resource out there. What's the single most, only natural resource that's not disappearing? Well, it isn't marshland, certainly isn't timber, it isn't wildlife. It's you and I. The experience and the value of people who've got the education and background that you and I have got is amazing. So JAB has a program called FISH, Friends in School Helping. Absolutely unbelievable program between the generations. That's just one example. And you can tell what young people think of old people. This guy is showing you what he thinks about older people. And I think the question for governments is not the fact that what goes on is a matter of giving money to one age or the other. It's the fact that we share a lot in common. And this is the Thomas Jefferson Planning District chart on various things they want to do, economic development, environment, historic resources. Well, I say there's one caveat they got to add, and that is every situation, they've got to deal with the aging population, their needs, and possible contributions. If you do that, then we'll have a good plan. And if you're a smart business person, you should say to yourself, God, think of that, 78 million people over 65, what can I do that they want? And very honestly, you can do a lot of things. There's a good book called Turning Silver into Gold by Mary Furlong, a really remarkable book, and it gives you some idea of what's going on. First of all, if you travel, over 50 consume 80% of all luxury travel. Healthcare, big chunk of it goes to older people. So take a look at the products that you got and say, how can I modify it? Remember how Depends used to look like big diapers? Well, now they look like jockey shorts. And they're very, very effective. This is a jar that holds a Minute Maid. It's condensed here so you can arthritic hand can fit around it. You read the print on this. They put enlarged the print. And the toilet facilities have gotten halfway sensitive, so it's good. Remember to take your Depends off if you jump in the pool, because as you can see what's happened, did not take the Depends off. It's lowered the water level. Hospitals have been slower to grab this whole concept. Very honestly, a lot of hospitals have pediatric emergency rooms. But I had a friend of mine who was 94, spent some time in a local hospital not long ago, and they don't have a geriatric facility. Progressive hospitals are now putting in parts of their emergency rooms that are specifically geared to deal with older patients. More comfortable, lighting different, sound is different, so forth. We're working on that. So again, I stress the fact that we've got a lot in common. I'm not going to talk about these next two things. I'm going to talk about this. As a community, the one thing that we need is a safety net. That safety net should have a lot of people involved in it. Family, friends, police, firefighters, all of whom ought to be aware of what we're talking about. Postal employees, bus drivers, church groups. If you put that whole net together, then you've got a safety net that will, in fact, really support the aging population very, very well. So it's an exciting time. It's a time when, in fact, it's the dawn of a new age. And we're going to see some. This is a guy on the beach, and he's like most Americans. He isn't cared about the age wave. Very shortly, he's going to have two choices. He can sink or he can swim. And neither of those are very popular. On the other hand, if he really is good, he's going to innovate. And what he's going to do, he's going to get a device that will shoot him up out of the water, and very shortly, he'll be flying with the jets. And that's what's going to happen in this. We just put together a new group here, Gordon Walker, myself, are involved, called the Institute for Innovations in Caregiving. And the first thing we're doing out of the gun is getting all the universities and colleges in Virginia to get their students together, showing what the caregiver problems are and asking them to invent apps that will help them with help people who give care. So we'll talk about that. Charlottesville been the beneficiary recently, the new open PACE Center in the Blue Ridge. And as you know, that's a remarkably good interdisciplinary program. Eligibility is over 55. You've got to live in the area of the PACE program, and you've got to be probably dually eligible. Some people can get into Medicaid, but that's going to be a very big addition. Co-housing. This is Elder Spirit down in Abingdon. Tremendous community. Everybody in the community is committed to helping everybody else. They gather for common meals. They have common government. And more importantly, they do, in fact, support one another in an environment that's just marvelous, beautiful place. The village concept's coming to Charlottesville. Whole areas of communities are banding together, getting services that are vetted, putting them together in a menu, and then saying they're going to support one another and allow people to live at home. So it'll be another big thing. JAB has been a tremendous resource in this whole battle, and they've done a good job. They're comprehensive. They look at housing, planning, zoning. They're doing all kinds of things that have made, I think, this a better place to live from that standpoint. Signage. I don't know. I was somewhere. I was in Washington for a meeting not long ago giving a speech. I got out at night, and the street that I came up on was suddenly blocked. And I got diverted off the side street, and I didn't know where I was because I couldn't see the signs. And the point I make to you is I could find this senior center because Elbert says, finally says, turn left. But there's enough reminders that I could find it. And then I got to have sidewalks I can walk on for exercise. This kind of thing cannot be tolerated. See something like this? Call Mayor Hoogee, and say the sidewalk's bad. More importantly, I got to have a place to sit when I get tired. That's another important thing. If you're going to design a community where older people are going to live, design it in such a way that they can walk to the store, to the pharmacy. They can have medical care available at some level, and they can exercise. Or, for example, what about the community's response to group homes? Not in my backyard. I don't want six old geezers eating my backyard. No way. What is the zoning ordinance for things like that? And you hear that hand all the time. Not in my backyard. They don't say it, but it's there. This is a neat thing here. You can take this modular unit, use this in the Army. You had mobile surgical units. You could drop the surgical unit down, and they use that today. And you can do all the major surgery you ever want in that trailer-like unit. This unit can be hooked up, dropped in the backyard, place for the person to get care, and a caregiver live in there. But again, in my backyard, what's the zoning ordinance about that? Will Charlottesville allow that? This was developed by a guy down at Tech. This is another interesting point. This is, of course, a group of people who can't see. They're all older people, for the most part, and they're blind. This is a Prius, not electric, and they asked them to raise their hand when they heard the Prius go by. You see two hands up. So if you're designing an intersection, and you've got an electric car that's silent, how do they find that out if they can't hear? Prius has gone back to the drawing board, and they put a noisemaker in their car, and that's better. And of course, two-story houses are great for Peter Pan. They're not good for people of my age. Doesn't work. So I maintain that the big problem that's coming down the road for Obamacare and the country is the fact that they put the cart before the horse. Got a system which got a lot of flaws in and of itself, but they do not have the horses to deliver that system. And that's going to be a real tough issue for them. This just gives you a look at the geriatric picture. Back in 2005, we had about 334 kids interested in becoming geriatricians. 36 people wanted to become faculty members to train more people. By 2007, whoop, we dropped down to 287 people wanted to do it. We're down to 34 faculty members. And that's continued to drop. Not a career that's been popular at all. And then what about Virginia's graduation in general? Well, we get about 39% of residents trained here get to stay, but a lot of them leave the state. And more importantly, where are the docs? Well, they're like Sutton's Law. They go where the money is. They ain't been rural areas. And these are areas that I showed you earlier have got trouble with rural health. So availability makes a big thing. Then the whole question about the reimbursement scale, which they are trying to address, is this. This is somebody getting a colonoscopy. This is a colleague of mine who's taking care of a lady who's fallen in the nursing home. He'll be there about 45 minutes, probably another half hour talking to the family and getting things together. This guy in 40 minutes will make more with that procedure than he'll make in a whole day seeing the rest of the patients he's got. So the system has got a lot of inequities about it. And then the CNAs, that's where the rubber meets the road in long-term care. They're involved in all kinds of everyday things in nursing homes. 65 to 85% are single mothers. Average age is 47. Now, if you're a single mother, what's the one thing you need? You need child care. Is that available? Could a community provide child care for, say, women police officers, women firemen, anybody? Does Charlottesville do that? No, they don't do that. You pay for it. And what you get is a wage that's a minimum wage for working as a CNA, and you end up paying a lot of that for your child care. So that's something to keep in mind. And I think the biggest reason I said in mind is manpower. What about technology? That's going to be a big difference. You can do things now from, say, you live in Northern Virginia, you take care of somebody in Charlottesville, you can communicate easily. Security is a big issue. This is one device called Independent. And with this device, you can video chat. I can talk to my in-laws up in Vermont. You can have text chats. I can do web browsing. I can play games. I can measure my temperature, blood pressure, weight. I can measure my blood ox. I can tell when somebody moves or doesn't move, all with a single device. So technology is making a big difference. If you got somebody with dementia, for example, they got shoes now. What the shoes do is they tell you when the person moves, where they're moving. I can turn on my computer screen and tell you where in the yard the individual is. All done that way. Telemedicine is a big help. Going to see things from great distances. This shows you the trouble with medications. If you don't take the pill, this bottle turns just like that. It looks moldy. Now, that means it glows red if you don't take the pills on time. And this is the most interesting recent development. This is a pill on a little chip. You take that pill in, when it's digested, it sets off an electrical impulse. A device can record it. And I'll know exactly whether, number one, I'll know where you took the pill. Number two, I'll know what time you took the pill. So it's very interesting. Here's a guy with his iPhone, got heart trouble, puts that on his chest, and there's the EKG, and he can send that to his doctor right by the phone. Don't need another thing. Doctor, tell you what the rhythm is. This is some of the equipment you're getting at home. Those home dialysis machines, all this stuff, all these things the caregivers are doing. This is a device you wear on your wrist. You've got a good friend who wears one. And on there is his entire medical history. Plug that in the rescue squad computer, take it to the emergency room computer, take it anywhere, and you don't talk to anybody. It's all there. See what your medicines are. So neat things are on the way. Device the iPhone, you can measure your blood sugar, and the blood sugar can be graphed, shows you what's happening daily, what time of day. And then you can send it to the doctor's office. The doctor can respond, or the nurse can respond. Tell you to take another dose of insulin, what you do, all done by the iPhone. Buildings, you can take livable for a lifetime. No steps. Don't build anything for me that has steps in it. Pull down cupboards, D-rings, a lot of design changes, different counters for handicapped people. And again, showers with no step-over thing at all, sinks and stoves which make accommodations, doors which have different handles on, and a step-in shower. All that stuff can be done. And above all, do not put stairs. That's for some people, you can see Mount Everest. That's the Mount Everest people have. Appliances are different, and above, steps. So that's a key thing. So live over a lifetime. So when all said and done, this is a lady whose husband is a pipe smoker. And he used to put the pipe out in the ashtray. Now he puts the pipe out in the mattress. So if she's not there, up goes the house, up goes him, up goes she probably. So she sits there 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, watching that cat. So to me, I think what I've summarized to you today is that caregiving is the world's toughest job. It's got emotional, physical, all those elements. And I think, how can you help? Every time you hear the word caregiver, say, what can I do to help you? Tell the politicians they need help. Tell them we need money. And this gives you some idea of the basic problem. This is written in a recent article called Letting Go of My Father by John Rauch. What he said was, how can it be that so many people like me are so completely unprepared for what is, after all, one of life's near certainties? What's that near certainty? The fact that you or I are going to be given care. What I needed was for the experts to find me and tell me what I needed. We should all be given time off work at age 40 to take a class of elder care. Now, we train every kid about CPR, but we do not train children about things like incontinence, dementia, and that's got to be part of the educational equation. Got to be put there. So we're working on doing that, getting into school. And the real problem is what you and I do ourselves. The healthcare problem is a problem because if we had not shirked our responsibility, if we had done more to, if we'll change our own lifestyle, then I think we'd make Virginia a better place for elderly citizens. And it's up to you and I. It's going to be a key part of the equation. So you look at this and you say, is that a sunrise or a sunset? Well, unless I tell you, you won't know. Took the picture over Colorado Springs a long time ago. And if we sit back and do nothing, and we neglect our own personal health, you and I will be part of one of the all-time great sunsets you've ever seen. And conversely, if we get up and say, no, I'm not going to accept that part of life, I'm going to change my lifestyle, I'm going to help get behind the community things that need to do with aging and so forth, then I think we'll have something to be good. So, to me, it's the dawn of a new age of innovative senior service program. What role senior statesman members play in this making? That's up to you. But how did I get to be 80? I have three things I got. I ride fast, I love hard, and I stay regular. So that's it. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Dr. Lindsay. A fantastic talk. I know we've got lots of questions. We podcast these things, as many of you know. So I'm going to ask you to raise your hand if you want to ask a question, and either Jim Who else has a mic? John, we'll come to you, give you the microphone, but don't talk unless you have the microphone. Okay.
Who wants to? Only ask questions I know the answer to, please.
All right, let's have a question.
Can you talk a little bit more about the role of the community and this village concept? Because we've had debates over at Branchlands about, should I take care of my neighbor? Should I pick him up off the sidewalk? And some people say no, because there's a liability and you could be doing more harm. Other people say, if I hadn't been picked up by a stranger, I wouldn't be here.
Yeah, I tend to be in the latter group. I think that the village concept worries a whole lot less about liability and worries about the common good of their neighborhood and their neighbor. And I think that transcends, in my mind, a lot of the legal things that could be part of that equation. And I think, very honestly, the village movements that I've been part of, Beacon Hill is in Boston, is one that I'm most familiar with. Of course, that was kind of the beginning. Huge section of Boston's involved. And they did some interesting things. They did things like they vetted all the various tradespeople that are involved in helping around the house, people to do painting and laundry, that kind of thing. But more importantly, they went out and set up contracts with Boston hospitals, and they get a discount for some of the rates that they do. And they've gotten tremendously, I think, improved health care out of the association. And one thing that you bring to the table if you have a village concept is you bring volume. There are people involved, and those people, merchants of all kinds, are interested in volume. So it's a trading chip that you've got when you have a village concept. But I think overall, it gets back to the basic thing about being a neighbor anyway, and that is some neighbors shut the door and never come out and don't know who you are. I agree. I would move if I lived in a neighborhood like that, I think, very honestly. And I've been very fortunate where I live in Charlottesville. I've always felt that one of the things that happens is that the neighbors are attentive, and I think that's a very important part of life. So I tend to be in the latter group rather than the former. It's a good question, though. Yes, ma'am.
Just in relation to that, does the Good Samaritan law apply in Virginia?
I'm sorry, you didn't hear it?
The Good Samaritan law?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, yep. As a physician, I think it's very much in vogue. Physicians are nervous about liability today, but I think the average physician worries about that after they've done whatever they need to do. In terms of this situation, I don't know with the application to the village concept. It's a good question. Maybe I'll find out and get it to Bob. We can put it out some in the newsletter. That's a good question. Yes, ma'am.
As a nurse, as well as a caregiver, as well as watching other members in my family, providing care for their spouses, the thing that concerns me most is this prolonging life when, in fact, you're not improving the functionality of that and our society. At what point are we going to start educating our physicians to help, to have those serious talks with family members to say, you know, this is the time you need to look at hospice, take your mom, take your wife, whoever it is, home, and allow them to die with dignity versus this protracted, lengthened death process and such diminished quality of life?
Well, I think that's a very appropriate comment, and I think I agree with you totally that we've not done a good job in the past. I think the last decade in medical education, nursing education, is, I think, doing a lot to correct that problem. But there's another issue involved, and that is the issue of making sure that everybody in the family is on the same page. And so often what I faced would be a situation where the people who were actually giving the care understood better than anybody what you're talking about, the need to have a dignified end to life. But a remote sibling who had no involvement in the caregiving whatsoever would suddenly appear and say, I want the works. Do not stop. And it's a very difficult position for the docs to be in. But I think both sides of the equation need to be educated. The families need to be educated. And most importantly, they need to make sure that whatever is done, for the most part, on the wishes of the patient that's involved whenever possible. And the one bit of advice is that's one of the things about early Alzheimer's. The time to do anything about what people want to do is when they're still not terribly involved with severe Alzheimer's. It's too late then. And that's where you get into trouble, where they haven't got a full definition. But you're absolutely right that that's been a major problem, and it still is in some places. Some people have real problems stopping the most vigorous treatment. The evidence is overwhelming that, in fact, Alzheimer's disease, when it gets to be late, is going to take people away sometime within the year that they're alive, in all likelihood, and no matter what you do. And if you treat things, my own situation in the family was that developed pneumonia, and we did not treat the pneumonia. And I think the answer is that you do prolong people to an existence that's just nothing more than an existence, has no quality of life whatsoever. And so I agree with you totally. It's a very good, I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, sir.
I have a feeling that at some point in your life you took an Evelyn Woods speed reading course.
Well, the usual comment I get is my ears can't hear that fast. That's what I usually hear.
I try to take notes at these meetings, but I couldn't even begin to keep up.
Well, that's how I get people coming back to hear me more than once, is that it takes them two or three times to get what I say. That's right.
If they were charging admission, that would make sense.
By the way, there is an admission charge. I forgot to mention that to you.
Is the information that you presented available online or someplace where we can go back and review it, or can that get into our newsletter and the recap, the summary, as to resources where we can get some of this information that flashed by?
That's a fair question. It's a compilation from a lot of sources, and I think I can make something available which gets the nuts and bolts. I can't put all things there. I've had some trouble in the past 4 years twice with giving speeches to audiences where the copyright issue got involved, and I was charged with infringement of copyright. Some of the material I have to be very careful about. But I think the nuts and bolts, we can get something together, sure. I have something already, so that's not a big issue. And it's a good criticism. I've heard it before, by the way. Yes, ma'am. By the way, this is an old friend, Linda Underdown, who's the new CEO over at Martha Jefferson House. So, Linda, welcome. Welcome to Charlottesville.
Thank you. Dr. Lindsay, you're so impressive and amazing. I didn't realize you were friends with Dr. Bill Thomas.
Yes.
Can you speak a little more about what he's doing, the greenhouse effect? And I understand it to be very high-tech, like interactive screens in the houses with nurses, physicians.
I can't so much about the later part of it. That's the high-tech piece which he's been working on. The part that I've had most to do with Bill about was the idea of downsizing the long-term institutional care of older people. And the nursing homes traditionally look like, you know, they look like what they are, buildings with multiple rooms off the wall. And what he wants, and what he set out to do with the Green Movement, was to create a facility where he's got, instead of one big building, a brick building with two long corridors with 20 rooms off each corridor, maybe six houses with six residents in a house, served by a staff that's individualized, knows the individuals in there, has somebody permanently living in the house with him so that there's somebody right there all the time. That kind of thing is what he's after. And I think Bill's a very, very impressive guy and has been a major force. That building I showed you in New England is another idea. It's a big brick building. But they've got something like 10,000 square foot floors in there, and they've divided them up. So they have a common living room, they have a common lounge, they have a dining room where people can come. They don't serve meals at any specific time. You can come and get meals whenever you want. So that what they're trying to do is impersonalize the idea of care of older people and get away from the fact that some people want to eat at 2 o'clock in the morning, some people don't. And it's a very, very, I think, it's like we live. That's what the people want. They want to live like they live when they were alive. And so that's what he's doing. I'm not familiar with the computer stuff, to be honest with you, Linda. I can't help you there.
Address the shortage of geriatricians in this area, especially every geriatrician I started with at UVA is out of the system now.
Yeah, I think that's been the problem. First of all, there's very limited number of people that institutions like UVA can recruit from. I told you the pool is very small. One of the reasons why people don't go into geriatrics, well, one is they haven't got any role models. Small pool, a lot of places don't even have them on the faculty. Secondly, what they've done in the past is the only people they've seen, students have seen, have been sick older people. It happens to people who can talk, who can tell them what it's like to fish a good mountain stream, any kind of industry. And so what they've got to change, they've got to change where they train them. They've got to train them in places where they're vibrant older people and recognize that, man, this is fun to talk to. I mean, one of the joys of being a geriatrician to me was not the fact that I took care of sick people, made them better, but the fact that I got to know people who had done things I've never done. And I usually show a slide of a colleague who I had as a patient who was the one of seven Americans that flew in the Battle of Britain. And I must confess, I know a little about what was wrong with him, but I know a whole lot more about the Battle of Britain because we spent a lot more time talking about that than we did what was wrong with him. And I think that's the point. And then the other thing is, the reimbursement scheme, which I spoke to earlier, the average debt for medical students today is between $120,000 and $160,000 when they graduate. They owe that much. And if you looked at the spectrum of careers and reimbursement scales for starting at the top, radiology, ophthalmology, anesthesiology, dermatology, somewhere way off the page, you'd see the word geriatrics. So if you had a loan, if you were $160,000 in the hole, and somebody gave you a menu to choose from of careers, and it said, let's see, geez, here's one that makes maybe six figures, really big numbers. What's this one? That's not it. That's part of it. And I think the third thing is family style. Lifestyle of a geriatrician is different than somebody who does radiology. Radiology has no weekends, no nights, and they have a lot of time for their family. I had a lot of nights, I had a lot of weekends,
which was part of being a geriatrician. So if you were a young person coming along today, one of the things they're demanding is they want family time. Unlike my generation, they say up front, this is one of my requirements. And that's why students are choosing what they call the road, radiology, ophthalmology, anesthesiology, and dermatology, all for the reasons we've just discussed. That's part of the reasons. It's a very good question and a complex question, and one I've worried about since 1970 and been unsuccessful with. I have some failures in my life, and that's one of them. I've not been able to say to an audience like this, man, we got people coming to the geriatrics by the bushel. What they're trying to do now in the Affordable Care Act, they're giving incentives, they're giving scholarships, they're doing everything known to man to try and entice people into it, but you got to put those other factors in the equation. So it's a really good question, one I wish I had a better answer to.
What's the take on long-term care insurance for those of us that are getting older?
Well, I don't have an answer I can give you that's concise, but what I would say is the time to buy long-term care insurance is around age 45. Because if you wait to now, if I bought long-term care insurance now, I'd have to sell my car. I haven't got the money to pay for it. Point is that the older the population that you enroll, because it's high risk, they know that, see, they're going to stick you with it. So the time to take it out, and then you have to read the fine print. What's the rate of increase, number one? What do they not cover? And that kind of thing. And as I say, many companies that used to give long-term care insurance are getting out of the business. So it's getting hard. The number of people that offer it are getting fewer and fewer. What's the future? Well, I think the future maybe we'll have to look at something like some type of nationalized long-term care insurance. How they're going to do it, I don't know, because it's a tough fiscal issue and one that they've had a lot of trouble with, though. I hope that they'll do something along that. Medicaid is one answer. If you can become poor, if you can spend down to the level of Medicaid eligibility, then you will be eligible for Medicaid. That's the only long-term, that's the final common pathway for people who want to get long-term care and have no long-term care insurance, is to get rid of all the things that you do. And, of course, you'd be charged with some type of felony for giving the money to your kids or doing something like that. But the point is that that's how you get eligible. And otherwise, you've got to buy long-term care insurance. And the older you are, the deeper the pockets you better have. I think I beat on yours enough here. I'll let you go. Thank you for waiting out the storm, and I enjoyed being with you.
Hey, I wanted to, Dr. Lindsay, thank you for this wonderful talk, but I just have one last question. Carry home. One's mother is coming to live with them, for example. One-stop shopping, where is the best place to get advice about all of the resources? Is it JABA?
I would think JABA.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
All right. Okay. All right. Dr. Lindsay, thank you.
Bob,
wonderful.
Thank you for having me. All right. Good to see you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.